Blog Talk Radio.
Just so many questions. Hello and welcome to Masonic Effects. I'm just bursting at the seams here today. Welcome. Thank you for tuning us in. It's much appreciated. How is it that look around? We know that we're going through this kind of evolution, transition. Things are changing. There's a sort of a refresh. We've hit the reset button in a way. You know, we're dusting off our expectations, and we're looking around and thinking, well, this isn't, you know, we've been put this in a time frame, listeners. When we see something that's existed for over 100 years, you think that's significant. That's, you know, in the area that I'm in North America, you see the average a really keen restaurants opening, brilliant ideas, 2 to 3 years, they're gone. They're on the market of being sold. It's like this interest. We can't hold our focus. The populi can't hold its focus very long. You know, we want something new, and innovative, and something engaging. Ha. Huh, well, I might say that we have this whole body of philosophy that's been floating around. Not one, but this curated. Field of philosophy that does just that. It's always on the edge of reevaluation, of renewal. There's a freshness, an intellectual and emotional freshness to it, because it replaces uncertainty. We ball up our little fists and get red-faced about this, but this replaces the heavy lifting that the world is going through with something much more precarious these days. I will grant you that, simpler, easier. It's not that we fall into decline, get ourselves into a real fix, and then wonder what to do. It's that we study these things before we find our shoulders pressed against the wall, before we're backed into a corner. We think, give it some serious thought. Some of us, some serious thought about ethics. This the major field of philosophy, the study of ethics. Now, that might seem glib to some. Well, just open up the chapter on ethics and slide across to where it says speculative Freemasonry. There's your answer. Not that simple, of course, but that's what we've been doing. We have we seem to have, I don't know how you sustain an intense conversation unless you're around, philosophers. I don't find them a morbid group at all. They're usually quite animated. And people that have that tendency are just like that. There's an enthusiasm. But I think what I like is that sense of humility. It's not the arrogance or it's not in any way hubris. This is maybe I'm projecting on you. You know, correct me here if I come across that way. That we ought to be able to do this with a degree of respect for the material itself. Now, yeah, as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, man, do you ever sound like you're in a lecture hall in a university? Huh? Where we may have the tremendous and wonderful debates, each line, each reaction, pressing the other to go deeper into their analysis and understanding, and vice versa. And it's wonderful. You sit in the audience and you're just scribbling your notes. So what's coming out of this is a deeper understanding, and we've been invited to sit in and witness that. Not that the idea, if you thought the hall empties pretty fast, if the professor is just dusting off the notes that he used in 1953, except there were things happening in 1953 that were jaw-dropping, and we would want to understand that, or to put it another way, if you know how to teach, if you know how to tell the story and engage, then it becomes discovery, engagement, and growth becomes something attractive and perhaps even inspiring. We don't have some things. We don't have the walls around us, the colleges built around us from 1000 AD. In 1000 AD is when Oxford University started. No, it was not the first, but it's, I just say that as a touchstone because it's familiar to many of us. We know that there were centers of higher learning through the Middle East. And I like to think we would expect that we don't study those has to do perhaps more with ethnocentrism than with a search of history, or maybe it's simply that history does require some sense of culture. To that penny that brings things into focus. Masonry, here we are, 100 years. Well, that's 125 years. Well, they've gone dark. Well, of course they failed. Our definition is really almost laughable. I wouldn't call that failure. I would refer to that as enduring. Enduring. 100 years ago, think back, just 1922. We finished how many wars? Crimea War, Boer War was in, that was over. The First World War, the trauma, 1922, the world was in a state of trauma, untreated. Think back. We want to go back to 122 years ago, 125 years ago. Victoria had just died. Queen Victoria. Then we were getting into George. The kings were coming along. All through that, these small lodges did gathered. They opened the they tied the doors and opened the sanctum sanctorum and practiced Freemasonry in whatever way, the best way they could. And I admire that. No, 125 years or longer, we could say, well, it's gone dark. A failure of what? A failure of what? We've got an interesting, we're using an interesting time frame to consider this a failure. There's a sadness. To be honest, I just to describe this thought for you. There's a sadness. And death is death. But there's a sadness when if it's a small child or a very young person, I feel this, something about this loss, truly the loss. And then you romanticize it and think what could have happened had that person, will never finish school, never get married or find a partner, and never travel, all those kind of nevers. It's different than if I'm talking to one of my old friends and then tomorrow he's dead. Well, if you're that, some of my friends are that old, you've met them. They're that old that it's not like, this is a complete unacceptable thought. It's like, it's what we do. And it's more likely to happen to a guy in his 90s than it is, the guy in his 20s, Although you look at the risk factors in the actuarial tables and you think, in our 20s, males, pretty high risk characters doing pretty stupid things. But you know what I mean? The point is making it, there's a difference. So I look at these lodges as gray-haired entities that have some life under their belt, and I'm not going to feel bad about that. I'm not going to feel bad that although it does take a reminding sometimes. Not everybody is an antiquarian, not everybody is a historian. Then we can remind lodges of these things. What was it like, your lodge when our late queen was put on the throne, young and untested, and here we are in nations that were healing, had major scars, borders that were being obliterated, and then the question of culture: how do we carry on? What about my family's pride, and what about your family's pride, and what about heritage? Those are all very, very important questions, but they aren't as essential in a way when somebody is trying to blow up your world and annihilate you. You have other priorities: survival. So what happens when how does a person get through that? I don't know if I've ever heard anybody, I've listened to some people that were survivors of the Holocaust, and I'm astounded at their bravery and courage and their bluntness. You don't talk about some days and some things you don't talk about. You need to let it fade into the past as much as possible. And then when we hear that, we know that we can't let that fade, but we understand that's healing. That's healing. So we heal. Life goes on. We have birth and life and death, and there's always that sense of renewal. I might not like to admit it, but it's true. There was somebody young and with a vitality where I can say, I used to be able to do that on the playing field. I used to be able to run that marathon. I used to be able to bike that mountain. And yeah, I used to be able to swim that river. And, And so you relive, you know, we have this vicarious satisfaction. And then, my goodness, I can walk into art galleries and think, oh, this is, you know, Jackson Pollock, you know. this is like, you know, like, there's just more of this beautiful work that's being created that wasn't there when I was born. So life goes on and we celebrate it. And so I'm not here to be an apologist for what's going on, nor am I here to say, oh, that's a failing of the fraternal order or male orders. No. It's this, we see comparatively, we see a lot of service clubs and organizations that once in the 50s and 60s were not having such challenges with membership, but neither were they thinking of the day when this abundance would come to an end. The organizations that are struggling are those that at least in my estimation, are those that forgot that, you know, when everything's rosy and moving along, who in their right mind would think, start to plan about the day when that might end? Well, the sensible people would. The sensible people would. We can mock them, you know. They're still around amongst us. Some of you had parents that were lived through the Depression, and you always had, you know, you looked in the pantry, and they always had that extra, didn't they? Never would go hungry again. Hunger drove a lot of families and influenced a lot of us when we were being taught respect, because somebody had gone. How many nights did you go without food, or you had an apple for breakfast? And how many of you, you know, how many, or there just wasn't enough to go around. And if you did, it was fortunate. It wasn't taken for granted. And then to replace that with this, we didn't replace anything. We didn't replace the threat that's still there and the struggle that's still there. We know more about it than we ever did before, thanks to modern technology, the gift that our ancient brethren would have been just absolutely thrilled to receive. Can you imagine the 18th century guy and somebody hands him a smartphone and says, well, there you go. By the way, in your hand, you can retrieve any bit of history. If you need just a little prompt and a reminder, as we tend to, it's at your fingertips. No. And by the way, you can take pictures and send that to me of whatever's going on, and I'll do the same. And we can communicate instantly. The miles, no. We don't have to wait till we visit 6 months down the road. We can do that. No, we can actually. Astounding. But altogether different, because there are those of us who weren't born with this technology around us, so it's new, relatively new, and yet there are other people around us, and you think they're getting a little older, that we're absolutely taking for granted because it's always been there. And in truth, for us to sit there and say, oh, no, it hasn't, well, knucklehead, for them, it has always been there. For my, you know, I have a daughter that's in her 30s and she's always had bank machines, you know, no big thing, bank cards. We can remember, you take your little bank book and put it up on the counter and the clerk would look at it and you give them your money and they would make it a little entry and you would, that was your savings from your allowance. Eh? And you would use that to buy your woggle for your new woggle for your scout troop and buy mom and dad their gifts for Christmas. Yeah. Lovely. Simpler times, relative times. So, We have to keep that focus. It means to have a reminder of what we're capable of doing. Our focus can and shift with the days. I particularly we can be forgiven by thinking, well, gee, that was, you know, I liked it before, you know, I liked it, you know, when I had a 3-speed shift on the column with a clutch, but I didn't like the brakes, hydraulic brakes, sign me up. And the metal dash that killed so many people, yeah, I could do without that. Monsters, you know, sitting in a vehicle the size of our living room couch or divan or Chesterfield. But that was all right. And spongy, you hardly had any feel of the road. But and the tires they weren't belted and would blow out with those big bubbles on the side of them, you know. All of that, and yet I like the design. Some of them are classics, but give me the keys to something right off the production line. Thank you. Yeah, I'm a fan of climate control. I'm a fan of the hyper-efficient, fuel-efficient engines and engineering. Absolutely. They're quieter, more comfortable, safer. Mm-hmm. Now, instead of, you know, having 4 or 5 tons of Detroit steel to protect us, we have things that collapse and absorb all that energy. So we can, the whole family, we can roll them over in a van, and there's a likelihood that all of us are going to get out. Never used to be that way. Remember? Yeah. And now we have computer screens in them to help us get where we're going cell service. So we're linked. We're linked. I never walked around when I was in my 20s. I never had that word. Here I am, linked. No. We can be, I think, impressed that our standard for success is different. It's different than the marketplace, than the agora. It's 125 years. Well, you ought to at least last that long. and longer. What's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? We can't make 200 years? Think about it. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. Well, and then people like me can come along and say, well, boy, here you go. It's... the ticket for that next 100 years, that train taking you down the track for the next 100 years. Oh, that's Spinoza and Descartes, you know, get in the car where they're teaching and they'll take you down further down the road. And when they're done, we're going to do an analysis. We're going to revisit Aristotle and he's, you know, yes, I'm afraid. And by the way, if any of you are wearing that little business about Pythagoras, we ought to understand the unity and the mathematics of connection. What did they know? They weren't talking about, I don't think, no, the term quantum hadn't been coined by then. But where does it start and stop? Well, if I told you the limit of masonry, that would be totally unfair because I would be cutting it off just by offering a definition. It is that, and it's not vague. It's not like, oh well, you just throw your hands in the air and go at it. No. This is the oddity, where the growth that we expected, you know, something about betterment, transformation. Is a very stark wake-up call, but done in private. And we get a lot of help from our friends, but what we see are the struggle in other people and our own struggle. It's the course of living, course of thinking, course of being, to take time out of our day to study and apply what we're studying, they have actually something that we would apply to thinking, abstract reasoning, reasoning and logic. I'll only stop here. If you're rightfully so, if you're feeling discouraged, the morale is low. Yes, I can certainly no disrespect. That is there. That's present. The answer depends. So there's a lot of questions out there. So there's not one answer. There are answers, but we have to be bold and start to search for them, because in the different lodges, different projects, the groupings of your mates have a different chemistry. Are still in that, have that natural inclination, that curiosity, and the work hasn't stopped. It's on their work, hasn't it? Their curiosity, their readings, their discussions with each other have never stopped. It's just in a quiet voice. Don't start throwing things quite yet. We define ourselves that way. Reread our ritual a little bit. We define ourselves. We're the people that are satisfied without drawing attention to our deeds, who without a comment, without searching for applause, or who will not talk about what he has done, will do, can do. Those kind of people. We don't compete with service clubs or charities. They do wonderful work. This is a group that are thinking ahead, just trying to use that and the advantage of context and the advantage of insight and awareness. So we'll get around to that wheelhouse again, whether René Descartes was on the path of something when he talked about the point, the purpose of life is about awareness. Hey, welcome to Masonic Effects. And you thought a lodge going down after 135 years was just, we should just, let's have the wake before we get on with anything. And let's prop that old lodge up in the pub and give it a proper send off. Because it's been remarkable, and it's left, they leave big footprints for us here. Speaking of big footprints, this is Miles Davis. Circle. So what was on my mind when it pushed out this commentary? Losing my potential. Now, you could say that's been happening since the 60s, and you'd be right. I'm not really, never really thought a whole lot about talking about potential, because it really doesn't amount to much. Without action, it's like some having lofty spiritual notions without acting on them. We can have wonderful moral essays in our own mind, but unless we act on the outcome, they're meaningless. Action. You take the wonderful idea, the intellect, put it to work. You have the ideas, you have the emotion, you have the intensity, the clarity. Losing my potential. As soon as I make that decision, I give up potential of all other choices. When we are children, we aren't burdened with this. Everything is potential. No matter the outcome or comparisons, we have nothing to compare. Oh, we have, adults that think it's parenting or it's training to point out all these choices, the so-called right choices. I mean, how many of them ever you see explaining to a child how to reason through so they can make those choices for themselves? No. We have nothing to compare. Not a jot of predictability, but a wealth of discovery. Those little people, smarter people than me, figure this out. It seems like they are more confident than us. Well, triggered a bit of hubris there, I'm sure. But they aren't any more able to predict outcomes. They aren't. It's the joy of discovery. Nothing seems to compel me to be philanthropic or to study the primacy of speculative Masonic thinking. I'm sure this isn't a school of thought, but a description of a window through which the world reveals itself to a humble student. You know, that aha, oh, did you notice? Which then is the challenge? To live with doubt and conjecture or attempt truth? Is this what is meant, as I suspect, by the depth of will? But I like my ego. It's so comforting. It lies all the time, but it's wonderful. It's consistent. Metaphysics is only part of the phenomena. As above, so below, physical and metaphysical. The mathematics of life and giving transports and living transports us beyond impressions and beliefs to deeper meaning. But the question of us, is it transformative? Not necessarily, but it could be. It really doesn't matter until it matters to you and me. You and I alone are the measure of efficacy. Walk up to the average person and they would think you odd to be speaking familiarly about history and philosophy. Where are you coming from, crazy old person? Profane lives also matter. In another way, it's another way of saying masonry is not about hubris, but hegemony, one act at a time, influence, one act at a time. I would hope our search for meaning is enriched by the information and dialogues you are able to experience with brethren. I would hope that. The chaos, I don't find what's going on around. Do you notice there's a geometry to it. There's a geometry to it. And there's some, I don't know if I'd say it's comfortable, but there's some things that, impress upon me. I'm far too judgmental. And when I become judgmental, I'm usually making mistakes without taking into account all of the facts and doing the math. Do the math. Here's people that do the math, really. Jazz musicians, they don't even do the math. It's like, you know that whole school of classical music where they have that sense of creativity that we usually assign to jazz. Well, people are doing that with classical music on the spot, just sitting down at the keyboards and with the instruments and playing. Yeah, here's Ben Webster, When I Fall in Love. Thank you. That works. That works. I don't know if I would have appreciated. I think, you know, even in hindsight, I would have appreciated anybody teaching me math if they had explained the connection with the arts, with music. I certainly would have appreciated that. It might have excited my little brain, you know. Might have tuned me in, I hope, but I was part of that, another experiment in teaching. Yeah. Today we have a good introducer to another bit of writing about somebody who pays attention to the kind of detail that some of us appreciate. Some of us appreciate it. When we can, it's the difference. You know, some people, you know, a car is transportation, and it is. And sometimes some people appreciate a leather interior or a leather wrapped wheel or some of the refinements, the comforts, you know, state of the art electronics in design. Some the detail matters. If it doesn't matter, it doesn't matter. Energy, if the detail of energy efficiency is appealing, well, there's some incredible engineering happening now. Just phenomenal design. It's hopeful. But, you know, we're coming to terms with the fact that we can't buy our way out of this. And that's really going to be quite hard on the markets. My goodness. Whatever are we going to do when we find the reality of trickle-down economics? So, dog eat. Good. What do you think? We're going back to dog eat dog. Everyone for themselves. Dickensian London. I don't think so. It might happen, and it's happening around the world. But nah. Step up. Put a pin in that one for a second. We're going to look at the work of a man named Lionel Johnson, in our Poets' Corner. Lionel Pigott Johnson. He was born in 1867, the year Canada was formed, and in Kent. And he died on my birthday, October 4th, but in 1902. And he's described as English poet and critic, who was notable for his fastidiousness and wistful lyrical poems. But he's mainly remembered as a typical representative of the tragic generation of the 1890s, which suffered from a fin de siècle decadence and melancholy. The end, you know, we had Victoria was in widow's weeds after Albert's death. But Johnson, and it had impact, you know, on the nation. This is imperialism and industrial revolution gone pear-shaped. Everybody's still reaping huge profits, so there was never a critic. Johnson studied at Winchester College and New College at Oxford, and then he went on to London, where he developed a literary career. We know he died at age 35 after falling on a public street and fracturing his skull. Our friend Lionel became quite familiar with the bottle. Yeah. When he was learning his trade as a writer, he he was hitting it pretty hard, and he his whole manner has shifted. He was under the influence of the angels. He became a recluse, and he suffered what they're politely calling a spiritual malaise. He was depressed. He was a mess. But he converted, you know, when you're a mess, and what do? You drink yourself stupid. You convert from Anglicanism to Roman Catholicism, you know. 1891, he did that. Yeah, of course, you know. I just become more penitent, and then I can, you know, ruin my liver. And then he wrote, it raises an interesting question I'm going to ask about character. He wrote a very solid study of the novelist and poet Thomas Hardy, no shrinking violet himself. And his works were of a caliber that in 1915, they were edited by none other than Ezra Pound. He died very, very early, you know, 35. But his friend, William Butler Yeats, left a touching portrait of him. Respect, eh? Respect. If you've ever had a close friend where you see that just such enormous talent during married to drink, you know, this that self-destruction, it's like, you know, is that what they need to keep the light burning so bright? And then it just all comes to an end all too predictably, too quick. This guy is known for his criticism was very reasoned and very considerate, which we like. So here, you know, you think about that in a different kind of a way. Literary criticism. Plato talked about it. He cautioned against the risky consequences of poetic inspiration in general in the Republic. And they're often taken as the earliest important example of literary criticism. There's a caution for poetic inspiration because, in a way, the poet is grasping illustrator pulling out a stereotype. And everything doesn't stop around a stereotype. Stereotype is very helpful because it lets us pause, take a snapshot in our mind so that we can study something. Oh, it's distorted right away. As soon as you do that, as soon as you stop it, it's like somebody throwing a ball through the air. You take a picture. Well, the ball doesn't stop because you take a picture of it. Similarly, the world goes on. Everything continues, all the motion continues, but we have that opportunity to pause, to lean in and to look at it more closely, whether it's that field of daffodils or the clouds, or whether it's the more decadent kind of poetry where you're looking at the harshness, at the cruelty, the coldness of what's happening around us. Well, it's all leaning into the detail. If it matters, well, it can. And we call when it does matter, we refer to that as culture. And the other, the business of getting on with life, that's incredibly important. And to all those people who have sore backs and chafed hands from their labors, they deserve our respect for doing those jobs that we ought not to, you know. They're certainly not something for you and I to do. My goodness, no. But without them, where would we be? We would be lost. We would absolutely be lost. So hubris, elitism around those kind of workers, those kind of people that are contributing in a major way, but overlooked, that's... Overlooking them is about us. It's not about them. This is a poem, a brief poem, and it's he entitled it July, and he also wrote one called August. Nice of him to do that. But you see, I told you a little bit about the background of the man. maybe he saw things a little clearer in some ways than is the norm for the rest of us. But listen to, I think this is quite fetching. Summer lightning. And by the way, I'm just looking at the change of the seasons around me. I should play some Vivaldi here. We're just heading, leaving off the colors of autumn and anticipating winter. The landscape just changes. And around where I am, it's snow as far as the eye can see and cold, biting winds. Exhilarating. Summer lightning, though, and rich rain. Roses. This is July. Roses perfume the hot air. You know that, like my auntie's place. All the breathless night is faint. All the flowery night is fair. Philomel, her joy or plate, sings and sings and sings again. What comes now? The earth awaits. What fierce wonder from the skies? Thunder, trampling through the night. Morning with illustrious eyes. Morning with the springs of light. Thunder round heaven's opening gates. Do we notice it? You say, it's just summer, it's hot. And that's what it would be. It's just a rainstorm. We're getting wet. Darn, we can't sit outside. We need to all clamber inside. Or we could have somebody describe lightning, dangerous. Summer lightning and rich rain. Some people that like this find similarity with in music, and when they walk in art gallery, they find that similarity. But we can't hasten it, can we? The crude and the vulgar is not always there. It's always there. But the culture, what's redeeming that we use, that we need, that we teach. That culture, that's something that you and I are quite capable of doing. quite capable of doing. Here. A little Bill Evans for us. Thank you. Paul, Bill Evans, Portrait in Jazz, 1960. I have an interesting piece of history to share with you today. So, again, and I don't say that this lightly. We're in the 1740s in the Netherlands, and we've been talking about this notion of women in Freemasonry, women being admitted. And it began to happen here, we know historically. But as this historian, Margaret Jacobs, points out, there wasn't a mention of it. This was a violation. Surely before this, we're considered, that was part of the letting the profane world leak into your lodge. You know, women? It's not done. But then, and this is uncanny because, you know, we're having, I think, the same conversation today where I am. As we piece together the reasons for this event, women in Freemasonry, Masonic reformers of the 1740s had demanded that women be admitted into the lodges on the grounds that sexual exclusivity contradicted their ideal of equality. Oh, I've had that thought. How many of you? How do you reconcile that? You know? Well, the thought goes on, isn't it? In that decade, possibly in response to women having been admitted, French lodges specifically outlawed the practice, a prohibition not lifted officially until 1774. We need to consider the possibility that the Dutch lodges, familiar with the French Masonic literature, could not effect the same prohibition because they were forced to respond to local pressures coming from outside the lodges. Certainly we have heard the hint of sexual slander in the attacks upon the order, particularly from the Calvinist ministry in the Republic. We've been through that before earlier in this study. The Reformed ministers were the same group who led the assault against sodomy that erupted in the Netherlands in the early 1730s. Now, remember, this even back from the time of Henry VIII, the term sodomy also included masturbation. So there were people that were put to death men were put to death because of the charge of sodomy. That persecution led to the execution of dozens of men accused of homosexuality, and it was widely commented upon in the European journals of the day. The degree of hatred directed against homosexuals in the 1730s and beyond appears to have been uniquely Dutch, and historians have connected it to a general crisis in the Republic. It coincided with a revulsion against foreign influences and the persecution of booksellers, the supposed purveyors of ideas that were libertine and unorthodox. Now, libertine is a word, it means a person, especially a man, who behaves without moral principles or a sense of responsibility, especially in sexual matters. The disregard for morality, yeah, that's the libertine. The persecution of homosexuals in the Dutch cities did not end in the 1730s. Less serious persecutions occurred in 1764 and 1776. Although none of the Masonic sources make mention of these events, we need to remember them and to bear in mind that in 1735, rioters in The Hague did bring up the charge of homosexuality against the Freemasons. These charges do not adequately account for the decision in 1751 to step away from the male exclusivity for at least this one Dutch lodge, but they may have played a role. Really? What's that do to your value system, huh? Knowing that piece of history, what does that do? Another accusation leveled at us. Must be homosexuals because they're all men. Something to ponder, perhaps, you think? Yeah. Unresolved, or is it an ongoing kind of a thought? What's the ethics of this? What do we know? Bastion of male values, eh? That's us. Thank you. Well, I look up and I see that it's the witching hour again. It just really fits, doesn't it? Accusations through history that seem to be floating back to us. What do we do with, are women a defense against the dark arts? What in the hell is going on? And yet, there's some, at the heart of it, there's this innocence. It's philosophy. How we practice, that's a shortcoming. That's a, you know, we practice around the world. So values are, we're being challenged in a way to prove that the ethics and ethical life is transferable regardless of culture. But the importance is always to respect the culture that you're in, always. So we're taught that our work, our thinking, our way of life is adaptable and ought to be. That's giving credit to the fact that, you know, a thoughtful person can do that and will do that. Because it makes good sense in some way, but it's also considerably honest to operate that way. Here we are innovators. Each time you're reading, you're assimilating all of this material, you're pulling it together for yourself, and you're demonstrating to us and to the world around what you feel and what you believe, how you're translating all that you know. And then we see the rest doing the same by varying degrees. We gravitate, we're sifting right now, and we're gravitating toward, you know, like-minded. We've always done that. So no more finger pointing. No more say, oh, that's inferior. That's just the way it is. That's just the way it is. And if we want to create the symphonics and that kind of harmony, well, that's where we need to sharpen our pencil and be more aware during our selection process. And even those values need to be transferable from one generation to the next. So no more, you know, we can't really build a successful lodge around strong personalities, because it needs more. We need the people with some clarity, but also that sense, sustainability. Sustain these ideas is to sustain the work of the lodge, the vitality of the lodge. The happiness, well, it's always there. There's ever present the wonderment of the fundamentals. You know, it's like, well, who cares? The arts and sciences, who cares? Well, we seem to be able to find reasons why all of that is significant day by day. Don't be thinking about masonry every single day, every single breath. It will find its natural place in your life. Always does. And in the meantime, commit acts of random Masonic kindness. Be innovating, be spontaneous, be who you are. But that idea of respecting each other's and respecting differences, and doing it, you know, how day be day touchy, painful. Come back and see us again. I won't be here next week. I'm going to take a week off. I'm going to be down at a conference in Virginia with some people that I haven't seen for a long, long time. But when I come back, I'll put in another show to catch up on that one. So if you don't see me next, if you don't hear from me next Sunday. Please, please know that I will return. And I look forward to being with you again soon. Thanks for tuning in. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Thank you.